Right, we're continuing with the larger and shorter catechisms. Having seen what the scriptures principally teach us concerning God, it follows to consider what they require as the duty of man. And so, we're now into the section dealing with the duty of man. Again, our catechism, the first section is what we're to believe concerning God. It's what we're to believe. This section that we're moving into now is what we're to do. And the last section of the catechism, which is centered around the Lord's Prayer, is what we're to ask. So, questions 92 and 40. Question 92 in the larger catechism, what did God at first reveal unto man as the rule of his obedience? Answer. The rule of obedience revealed to Adam in the estate of innocence and to all mankind in him, besides a special command not to eat of the tree of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, was the moral law. Question 40. What did God at first reveal to man for the rule of his obedience? Answer. The rule which God at first revealed to man for his obedience was the moral law. We can see already the larger catechism is dealing with the question at hand in a much broader, much more nuanced fashion. The shorter catechism deals with man generically and moves right into this idea of the revelation of the moral law. The larger catechism very clearly ties this back to Adam, ties it back to what we would call the covenant of works, makes clear, in fact, that this rule, which is revealed to Adam, is actually revealed to Adam for all mankind. In fact, in some sense, it's revealed in Adam to all mankind. So we're going to talk about the rule of obedience first revealed to man. We'll talk about the estate in which man receives this revelation. It's very important, actually, that we understand that. We'll then talk about the fact that because of Adam's relation to all men, all mankind, that this rule revealed to Adam is really to all mankind. And then finally, we're going to talk about that special command. And that special command, discussing that, will actually give us an opportunity to look at some ways in which this moral law that we're concerned to understand as a rule of obedience differs from that particular command upon which what we would call the covenant of works was actually made to hang. So we've already We in the first section already talked about the fall of the covenant of works and so on.
The covenant of works hangs on a positive moral law or positive moral command.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the moral law really is an adjunct to that. And the fact is, and we'll talk about this more when we get to the end, but the moral law that we're talking about functions as an adjunct both to the covenant of works and to the covenant of grace. So it's going to do both. That's precisely why we're concerned with this moral law. And as we're going to see in later questions in this in the Catechism, the moral law is summarily comprehended in the Ten Commandments. But this is something which precedes, predates, antedates the giving of the Ten Commandments. Ten Commandments are simply a reiteration, a recapitulation of this moral law. The differences that occur or that are embodied, those there are things that we can talk about with respect to the moral law in terms of each of those commandments, and we will in each and under the heading of each commandment. So it's interesting and it's important to see that this moral law actually antedates the giving of the Ten Commandments. So there's not really a time, if we understand the larger catechism question in particular, there's not really a time at which man exists without or apart from law, moral law. That exists in the state of innocence, and it also continues down to the present in a fallen estate. So there are a lot of questions that can come up. We're going to try to focus on these few that have been outlined in these particular questions because the fact is the catechism does, especially the larger catechism on the law, does a tremendous job in dissecting and parsing all of the different aspects of this moral law that we should understand to be set before us. All right, so the first question then. What was the rule of obedience first revealed to man? And the answer is the rule of obedience first revealed to man was the moral law. We're going to begin looking at Romans 10, verse 5.
Romans 10, verse 5. For Moses describeth the righteousness which is of the law, that the man which doeth these things shall live by them.
And these laws, we should understand, take their rise from the holy nature of God, wherein is grounded our obligation to obedience. Look at Leviticus 20, verse 7, Psalm 111, verses 7 and 8.
Leviticus 20, verse 7. Sanctify yourselves, therefore, and be ye holy, for I am the Lord your God.
Psalm 111, verses 7 and 8. The works of his hands are verity and judgment. All his commandments are sure.
And this, we should understand, flows not merely or even principally from the command of God, but from their being agreeable to his divine perfections. If we look, for example, at Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11.
Exodus 20, 8 through 11. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it.
Right, and from that there may be ascribed the reason for God assigning them as a matter of duty. Look at 1 Peter 1:16 and Exodus 15:26.
1 Peter 1, verse 16. Because it is written, be holy, for I am holy.
Exodus 15:26. And said, if thou wilt diligently hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God, and will do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of these diseases upon thee, which I have brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that healeth thee.
So, when we talk about the laws taking their rise from the holy nature of God. But we need to be very careful. That is, we need to understand that God commands these things, and they're right, not in an arbitrary sort of way, but they're right because these are the things which reflect the proper relation between the Creator and the creature. Right? These are not... What we need to avoid in our understanding here, we need to avoid thinking that these are rules, if you will, which bind God. These are not laws that bind God. They bind us by His command. The command is rooted in His nature, and that nature, as particularly as it is related to the creation.
So would it be right to say that God is not bound by His laws, but He's bound by His covenant?
Yes. The covenant is God binding Himself. It's a voluntary binding of Himself.
Because there's nothing that can impose a law on God.
God is a law unto Himself, and there's a higher righteousness of God, and you know, for example, when we get to the Ten Commandments, they don't properly apply to God. You know, there's just simply no possibility of God having some other God beside Himself. You know, that would not only would that be impossible, it would mean He would deny Himself, but it would also imply that there is sort of a divine insanity. Right? And none of these other things. I mean, He can't steal because everything is His. You know, there's no possibility of the unjust taking of life because all souls are His. Right? He doesn't owe any particular duty to Himself that would be apart from what He wants to do for Himself. Yeah.
So when people say things like, oh, it's not fair that God, you know, my grandma died last week, it's not fair that God let that happen. Well, that's false, because it is fair, because all life belongs to God, and He has the sole prerogative to disperse and dispense with it how
yeah,
He chooses, correct?
In the Bible, He says He has the power to give life and to take it away. I mean, He has not only the dunamis, the physical power, but He has the authority, the exousia, to do so. And nobody's in a position to second-guess all of that. So, while these rules, this moral law, while that is, in fact, made a duty for us, and the making of it a duty for us has reference to the nature, the divine nature, nature of God, we shouldn't think of this as God decreed this because it's right, in the sense that there's some higher canon of right or wrong, and God has to respond to that. God does decree it because it's right, and it's right because of the nature of the relation inherent in the creation. Right? So it's right for us. This is what's right and good and just and so on for us. You know, given that we are creatures created in the image of God, this is what's right for us. So He decrees it because it's right for us. And the rightness of that is grounded in the divine nature. But that does not mean that there's some sort of higher standard, some sort of elevated morality that's over God. You know, so that you can say, if God does something, that it could ever be wrong. You know, whatever God ordains is right. By virtue of the fact that he ordained it. And what he ordains is, in fact, in keeping with that which is conformed to the nature of the relation that has been established in creation. Now, that's why these laws, these moral laws, are reducible to what we would call the law of nature. Romans 2, 14 and 15.
Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. For when the Gentiles which have not the law do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another.
So we call it the law of nature, not because this this is something which just simply arises from the nature of God, abstractly considered, but because it's grounded in the nature of God as considered vis-a-vis the creation. Right? The law of nature assumes its position. It assumes its character for mankind precisely because man is a creature created by a particular God.
So the law of nature is sort of a little bit broader, if you will, than the moral law.
The law of nature is reducible, at least in terms that have moral bearing. It's reducible to the moral law. And the law of nature also has to do with matters of order. But even in that, there's some referent to morality. It has to do with the nature of the creature with respect to the creator. Right? The creature is by nature to render a fit and due obedience to God, to the creator. And everything that makes it a fit or due obedience is really contoured by the divine nature. So that we're not just rendering an obedience to any old god or any old principle of divinity, but the moral law, this is why the law of nature, why it is such an important thing, is it actually reflects the standard of obedience due not to any principle of divinity, but to the real God, to the God who made us, the great creator, the real creator, not some divinity dreamt up by men. So we call it the law of nature because of its agreeableness to the dictates of reason, is also called the moral law. Look at Luke 12:57 and Ephesians 6:1.
Luke 12:57, yea, and why even of yourselves judge ye not what is right?
Ephesians 6:1, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right.
Yeah, for this is right. Paul can say it's right. Jesus can say it's right. How do you know it's right? Well, you know, because it is innate. It's concreated in the man. The very person of mankind. You have this sense. a moral compass. You know certain kinds of things are right or wrong. You don't really need to be told that. This idea that nobody told me. No, nobody needed to tell you. It's just an additional courtesy that you're being told so often. And it's an additional aggravated wickedness that you're not listening so often. But because it is, in fact, the law of nature, it resonates with the dictates of reason. In other words, all you really need to do is meditate upon the idea of morality. And you should come to these kinds of conclusions. The best heathen philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, find themselves coming to these kinds of conclusions. They're not entirely blinded, not at least to the dictates of moral law. They may not know that the God who is, but they know that there is a God. And they know that they owe him service in some respect. They need to seek him, that they need to honor that God, that they need to serve him in a way that he's commanded. They understand this. There's a reason why Socrates rebukes the worship of the heathen, the polytheism of the day. Socrates knows. How does he know? Simply by contemplation. He is a rational man. What is rational? The moral law is rational. The moral law fits very neatly into the contours of basic reason. There's nothing unreasonable. Right? That's another problem that the wicked have, when they're faced with this duty. There's nothing about it that really is unreasonable. Now, arguing against the moral law is arguing for insanity. That's why, again, Jesus and the apostle, they can say, that's what's right. You know it's right. And that's why it constantly binds and directs the manners of all men. It's right.
So not only are sodomites buggers, but they're also insane?
Anyone who rejects the moral law. But yes, they're insane. There's insanity. The wicked aren't just wicked. They're insane in their sin. They're not just stupid. They're out of their minds stupid. Right? They've left off all reason. And what happens when you leave off reason? You become like an animal.
Isn't that one of the judgments of God when he gives men up to all these vile affections? He hardens their heart against their own natural reason.
Yeah, they're made to abandon all reason. There is a reason why evil, from just the point of view of logic and basic rationality, why that is perceived to be unreasonable. There is in court of law. You go to a court of law, and they will very often make that appeal to what is reasonable. Was it reasonable? Is the standard reasonable? Was it the attempt to comply reasonable? Is your objection reasonable? All of that's an admission that there's some higher moral law, that there's some higher component, and a moral component of rationality, to which we're all being held accountable, or should be held accountable, to some degree. Right, we're induced to yield obedience to this law of nature, or moral law, when first of all, we consider that we are creatures, we're led to confess that we're subject to God, and therefore bound to obey Him. Job 37:7 and Psalm 64:9.
Job 37, verse 7. He sealeth up the hand of every man, that all men may know his work.
Psalm 64:9. And all men shall fear, and shall declare the work of God, for they shall wisely consider of his doing.
As creatures, we have to confess that we're subject to God, our Creator. And if we are subject to Him, then it is only reasonable. It's only within the canons of rationality that we would obey, that we would be bound to obey. That is something which should be apparent to all men. And in fact, it is. It takes an additional exertion for someone to harden him or herself against that realization. Because it's innate. You don't need anyone to tell you that there's something greater than you, something which has given rise to you. Second, we think of the absolute perfection of God. We understand this obedience must be agreeable there too. Compare what Bildad said in Job 8:20, and also look at Psalm 19, verse 7.
Job 8:20. Behold, God will not cast away a perfect man, neither will he help the evildoers.
Psalm 19, verse 7. The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple.
Yeah, there's nothing irrational, nothing absurd about this demand for obedience. The absolute perfection of God, upon reflection, that alone should argue that. Right, third, we remember God is a spirit. We are reminded that obedience must be performed in a spiritual manner. Job 32:8 and Romans 7:14.
Job 32, verse 8. But there is a spirit in man, and the inspiration of the Almighty giveth them understanding.
Romans 7, verse 14. For we know that the law is spiritual, but I am carnal, sold under sin.
And fourth, we recall that he's a holy God, and therefore he ought to be worshipped in reverence and holy fear. Psalm 96:9.
O worship the Lord in the beauty of holiness, fear before him all the earth.
So the rule of obedience is the law of nature or the moral law. It is a law which is conformed to and reflective of that natural rationality, and if we only reflect upon all that is in view here, being creatures, and we reflect upon the nature of the divinity, and that all together should lead us to conclude a number of things about the nature of obedience that we must render. The fact that we must render obedience, the fact that it ought to be agreeable to the perfection that is God, the fact that it ought to be spiritual, and that it ought to be holy. These are all things which should be apparent simply as we meditate upon the nature of the creation, the created order, the fact that there is a God and that He's created us, that we have this innate obligation, and we know that we have this obligation because we have this innate knowledge of the moral law. So the law of nature is not only established in the relation of things, not only to God, but to each other in the creation, but the law of nature is also something which is conformed to our rationality in such a manner that Paul can say of the Gentiles who don't have the written law, that they still have the work of the law written in their hearts. That is, their rational capacity is framed by that law. So you think in those categories. You know, you think in terms of right and wrong, good and evil. You think in terms of obedience versus disobedience. There are a lot of categories that you have. They're innate. Why do you have them? Where did you get them? It's part of possessing rational being.
It's not even possible to think of something other than right and wrong, correct?
Not rationally.
Not rationally. You can create your own category of whatever that action is, but ultimately you still know it's right or wrong, correct?
Yes. And you can try to evade it by asserting that that's just simply a subjective thing, but I would argue that the fact that everyone has this subjective apprehension, the work of the law, argues that there is an objective law of nature to which this work of the law that is in them rationally is conformed.
So that's sort of what somebody's referencing. I hear a lot of people, especially nowadays, saying this is what's right to me, or this is my truth, and things
like
that.
Yeah, all they're doing, they're recognizing that they have a conscience, but they've not stopped long enough, or they're not smart enough to understand that the fact that they're even thinking in categories of right and wrong, good and evil, obedience, disobedience, and that all of this implies, because everyone has this, that there is something objective making that impression upon you. That there is really a law of nature, a moral law. You know, so it's embedded in the creation, and it's reflected in the very structure of rationality in the creature, the rational creature. You know, animals, brute beasts, irrational animals do not respond to reason. Right? They don't do something because it's right or wrong. They may do something because it causes pain or gives pleasure, but they don't have a concept of right or wrong.
Just like the moral law is embedded within nature, the idea of magistracy, that's rooted in nature, not grace. But does that mean that people like anarchists, that they're just insane because they deny the whole idea that you need government? Is that almost insanity?
It's not just insanity. There's actually, the philosophical term for it is solipsism. Okay? The idea that they're the only ones who really exist.
Which makes them their own God.
Well, sure. You know, there's nothing outside of them. There's nothing objective. That their subjectivity is, in fact, the very standard through which, by which, everything ought to be determined.
Is that how some of these ancient kings and rulers ruled? Just by their word was law.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but even they, even though they do this on occasion, the fact is that they would very often appeal to a higher morality, something outside of themselves. You know, they weren't all so even though their law or their word was law. Right, they still would try to tie it to something higher. You know, like the Egyptian pharaohs were, their word was law precisely because they were the children of the gods. So that they're tying themselves to some higher aspiration, some higher source of morality.
So they were the vicars of their gods on earth.
Yeah, that's exactly what they were. Mm. All right, let's move on to question two. Was this law, this rule of obedience, was this revealed to Adam in the estate of innocence? The answer is yes.
Ecclesiastes 7:29. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 29. This only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions.
Yeah, and that, the word translated upright, yeshar, in the Hebrew, it means to be straight or righteous. So, this original, there's an original rectitude, rightness, uprightness of the original man, Adam. Look at Genesis 1, 26 and 27.
Genesis 1, verses 26 and 27. And God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them.
This uprightness, then, indicates a con-created straightness, which consists in an innate knowledge of that which is right, that is, an original righteousness, which is what is referred to in Colossians 3:10 and Ephesians 4:24.
Colossians 3, verse 10, and have put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. Ephesians 4:24, and that you put on the new man, which after God is created in righteousness and true holiness.
So man is, he's created upright, which means that there is con-created in him that conformity to this moral law. Okay? The moral law is objective. His rationality is subjective and moral. And between the two, as God created man, there's no discrepancy. Right? The objective moral law and the subjective rationality which is conformed to that moral law fit together like a hand and glove. Perfect fit. We thereby understand that the moral law was so distinctly written in his heart and impressed in his nature that it was equal to an express revelation. Genesis 2, verse 7 and 3, verse 8.
Genesis 2, verse 7. And the Lord God formed man of dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul.
Genesis 3, verse 8. And they heard the voice of the Lord God walking in the garden in the cool of the day. And Adam and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God amongst the trees of the garden.
And why were they hiding? Because they already know. You know, you just went from objective moral law and a subjective rationality, which is moral, that fit together perfectly. Now they've been blown apart. They don't fit anymore. What that means is, when man was created upright, the way he was created, the way his rationality was formed, was so that it actually possessed the distinct imprint of this objective moral law. And that's the work of the law on his heart. And that is the equivalent of an express revelation to the man. Right? He feels the power of the law, the rightness of the law, the work of the law. He feels it touching his entire rationality in perfection. He's sensible of this. And we know he's sensible because as soon as it's broken, what does he do? He reacts to that. Right? He knows he's fallen.
And that's what shattered in man after the fall, correct?
What?
His understanding of the moral law?
No, it's not. That's not shattered. What's been shattered is the relation that he bears to that law. Hmm. And that has consequences for the rest of his being. Right, being thus created in the image of God, Adam knew his duty fully, and he was perfectly disposed and able to perform it. We'll look at 1 Timothy 2:14, Isaiah 45:12-13.
1 Timothy 2, verse 14, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived was in the transgression.
Isaiah 45:12-13. I have made the earth and created man upon it. I, even my hands, have stretched out the heavens, and all their host have I commanded. I have raised him up in righteousness, and I will direct all his ways. He shall build my city, and he shall let go my captives, not for price nor reward, saith the Lord of hosts.
So Adam is created upright, and the uprightness actually consists in a perfect disposition and ability to keep and perform all that is in that moral law. There's no discrepancy, because he's not just a rational being, he's a rational moral being. And all that subjectively is comprehended in that is perfectly conformed to everything objectively implied when the Bible says he was created in the image of God, when the Bible says he was created upright. Adam has all of that. And this moral law is revealed to Adam in the manner and object of his creation, and in his nature and in his constant communion with God. There's no break. There's no breach. Right? How is he communicating with God? Well, presumably it's a rational communication. Why do I say that? Well, after the fall, we have God walking in the garden. It's really a pre-incarnate Christ walking in the garden and calling Adam, "Adam, where art thou?" That is rational discourse. That's a call to rational discourse. It's really not much different from what we find in Isaiah 1, where the Lord says to Israel, "Come now, let us reason together. Let your sins be as scarlet, they'll be white as snow," and so on. Same kind of thing going on here. Come, let us reason together. There's a reasoning. There's a rational basis for this communion. Right? God created rational creatures in order to have rational communion with Him. That's the purpose of creating man with this capacity for rational communion. This is the reason his nature is created to be conformed to the impress of this moral law. Because again, the moral law is expressive of the proper relation which the creature ought to bear toward the Creator, and as a result of that, toward fellow rational creatures. All right, question 3. Was this rule given to all mankind in Him, that is in Adam? The answer is yes. Again, Romans 2, 14 and 15.
Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law to themselves, which show the works, or the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts, the meanwhile, accusing or else excusing one another.
Right, so what the apostle's telling us here is there really are three things that we can take away. First, that the Gentiles have not the law. That is to say, they don't have the law of Moses or the written law.
Although they didn't have the law of Moses, did they still have a written form of the Noahic code?
No. There's no written law.
Okay.
All right. We're gonna look at what they have. All right. So they have not the law, or the written law. Look at Psalm 147, 19 and 20, and Ephesians 2:12.
Psalm 147, 19 and 20. He showeth his word unto Jacob, his statutes and his judgments unto Israel. He hath not dealt so with any nation, and as for his judgments, they have not known them. Praise ye the Lord.
Ephesians 2, verse 12. That at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel, and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope, and without God in the world.
So they don't have that law of Moses. That's clear. And that actually then begins to raise some other questions because of what he's told us. They may not have that revelation of Moses that the Israelites did, the Jews have later. But that does not mean that they are, in fact, amoral creatures. Right? That's not something which comports with rationality. Amorality is not rational. 2. Nonetheless, that they yet have a law within them, for they are a law unto themselves. Romans 1:19. 32 and Romans 2:12.
Romans 1 verse 19 and 32 verse 19. Because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has showed it unto them. And verse 32, who knowing the judgment of God, that they which commit such things are worthy of death, not only do the same, but have pleasure in them that do them.
Romans 2 verse 12. For as many as have sinned without law shall also perish without law.
and as many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law.
So this idea that they're a law unto themselves. Well, this is a natural law. Right, which is all one with the moral law. That's really the point. The people who think these are two different things are sorely mistaken. Natural law, properly understood, is the moral law. And the moral law, properly understood, is, as we will see later, summarily comprehended in the Ten Commandments. That is to say, Ten Commandments are simply a summary. They're not an exhaustive exposition, but a summary of the teachings of natural law. However, this natural law is less clear and distinct than the written moral law, not because of any inherent defect in the revelation, but rather because of the corruption of the nature through sin. In Romans 1:18 and Romans 8:3.
Romans 1:18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness.
Romans 8, verse 3. For what the law could not do in that it was weak through the flesh, God sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh, and for sin condemned sin in the flesh.
Okay, so the fact is, the defect is not in the natural law. When people say the natural law is not clear, they're not exactly correct about this. Natural law is actually just as clear as ever, objectively speaking. The problem is, because of the subjective reality of sin, the subjective point at which there's reception, that isn't any longer clear. Right? The receptor is defective. You know, it's not the radio transmission, it's the radio. It's supposed to be picking up the transmission that's become defective. That's what's going on. So if you had a clear radio to receive that signal, you would get it. This is why, by the way, people who are favored with divine revelation are actually in the best position to read natural law, to understand natural law. Recipients of this special revelation, because they alone are in a position to get an uncorrupted transmission through the special revelation that is corrective and instructive, and in fact acts as a what we might call a booster for the signal, so that you get a better reception when it comes to the natural law. So natural law is less clear and distinct than written moral law, not because of anything inherent, but rather because of the receptor, us, because of sin, because of the fall. It's important to affirm that. You know, this is why there's no excuse, right? It's not that the revelation has become less clear. It's simply that the persons in whom this revelation is to find reception have become more insane in their sin and less able and willing to receive the clear light of that revelation. Third, we're told actually how they have this law. It's not through their own making or devising, nor is it a matter of tradition. But they have it by nature derived from Adam. Romans 5:12 and 1 Corinthians 15:22 and 45.
Romans 5:12, wherefore as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned.
1 Corinthians 15, verse 22. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. Verse 45. And so it is written, the first man, Adam, was made a living soul. The last Adam was made a quickening spirit.
Yeah, so this is not in them. Natural moral law, contrary to what some people think, it's not something customary. It's not something traditionary. Right. There may be customs, there may be traditions which spring up around it, but properly speaking, natural law, which is moral law, is neither. They didn't make it up. You can't make up natural law. Which is why it can't be custom or tradition. It can't come from your own devising. That wouldn't make it natural law.
That affects head coverings then, right? Which is why it's not customary or tradition, it's natural.
It has bearing on the issue of head coverings, yes. It is natural. It is grounded in nature, and the nature that we're talking about is, in fact, the nature of that creational relation between the Creator and the creature, and then reflectively between the creature and the creature, the rational creature and the rational creature. But the work of that law is written in their hearts. That's what I said. When man is created, there's this concreation where man is created rational, a rational moral creature. There's an uprightness, a moral uprightness, and that moral uprightness is reflecting. When we say it's written in their hearts, we're talking about that idea that I mentioned before. This objective natural law, this objective moral law, has been impressed upon the hearts of all men, beginning with Adam. Adam was created with this original impression, so that just like a die in a machine shop, when it stamps itself on a piece of metal, that metal and that die, again, they fit together with a certain perfection. Like there's a certain totality of contact between the die and the piece of metal. Well, there's a sense in which God has taken this moral law, this natural law, and used it like a die and stamped it in the heart or the mind, the rational mind of man, so that there's this entire congruity. That the rational nature of man is made to bear that impress of natural law. That's the work of the law written in their hearts. When the Bible talks about hearts, it's talking about the mind of man, the rational mind of man, but as it is affected. So he is, it's impressed in such a way that man is affected before the fall. He's affected. That is, he's wholly disposed to the keeping of that law. Right? All of his rational, moral nature is bent toward the keeping of that law. There's nothing there that's going to make him say, well, wait, that doesn't seem right or upright or rational. It's such a work that cannot be wholly erased. Telling them what's right or wrong, their consciences bearing witness. Look at Genesis 20, verse 5, Romans 1, 19 again, and John 8, 9.
Genesis 20, verse 5. Said he not unto me, she is my sister? And she, even she herself, said, he is my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this.
Romans 1, verse 19. Because that which may be known of God is manifested in them, for God hath showed it unto them.
John 8, verse 9. And they which heard it, being convicted by their own conscience, went out one by one, beginning at the eldest, even unto the last. And Jesus was left alone, and the woman standing in the midst.
So what happens? Well, you know, when you have a die out of alignment, it's not wholly erased, but it no longer fits together. There's a disconnect. So that subjectively, the relation that you're bearing to this natural moral law is off. And that... that's reflected in the nature of man from the moment Adam falls. This is a problem that people have because of the fall. You know, the die isn't off. But to keep extending the analogy, the metal that is going to be stamped, that's off in the die. And so it's not getting a true picture of what the die is stamping. It's not receiving that in a proper manner so that it's receiving the impress in totality and you know, with in a manner that continues to incline it to that obedience. Now that's changed. It's been shattered by the fall. And that poses a huge problem for sinners of mankind. We're not in a position, and as more people are born, you know, that relation between the die and that piece of metal gets put under that die, and it's just always in a different place. So, you know, some of us have a more pronounced sense of the law with respect to one thing rather than another. You know, for some people, certain aspects of that law are dimmed or dulled. And then we do a number of things which are designed to inhibit that. And so that it doesn't get fixed. That's because of sin. But it's still there. Objectively speaking, that natural moral law is still there. And it's still clear. The problem is you are not receiving it as a clear impress. The problem isn't the natural morality. The problem is the receptor. Your nature has been corrupted by sin. You're not receiving this in a proper fashion. From all of these, then, we may deduce that there's nothing in the natural law or the law of nature, but what is a matter of moral law. And that's important to understand. It's a mistake to think that natural law is something different than moral law. It's also a mistake to think that moral law is something different than natural moral law, something different than the Ten Commandments. Because there's no substantive difference. That's called law because it not only directs, but it binds to duty. I'll look at 1 Corinthians 9:21.
1 Corinthians 9:21. To them that are without law, as without law, being not without law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without law.
So, we call it law because it binds to duty. You know, rational, remember, when man was created upright, with that straightness that we talked about, man was inherently inclined to a fit and due obedience to that law. Right? The duty that God was requiring in the law, that duty was not something which was onerous, right? You weren't going to sit back and say, oh, that's a terrible thing. Terrible that I have to obey that. No, it was not viewed, it would not have been viewed by a man who's upright as something difficult or burdensome. It's only become a burden to bear that because as an ingot being placed under this die of the moral law to be stamped, we're not properly positioned. So we're receiving it in some areas with much more weight and much more severity than in other areas. We're not rightly aligned. So it's not, you know, as a transmission, it's not coming through. But it binds to duty. That's what the very nature of law. It's just before the fall, such was that relation that it bound to a duty, it bound us to duty in a way that was perfectly conformed to our rational moral disposition. So it didn't feel burdensome. It didn't feel like a difficult thing. And by this light and law of nature is made known to all nations in some measure, sufficient knowledge to lead the heathen without excuse for their disobedience. Look at Romans 2:12 again and Jude 10.
Romans 2:12. For as many as have sinned without law shall also perish without law, and as many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law.
Jude 10. These speak evil of those things which they know not, but what they know naturally as brute beasts, in those things they corrupt themselves.
Yeah, so, again, this is a law. The rule is given to all mankind. It was given to them in Adam. It was given to them in Adam because we receive our nature from Adam. Adam received the nature of perfect conformity, but he's transmitted one that's out of alignment. Nonetheless, going back to that radio analogy, you know, we may have bad receivers, but they're still receivers. In other words, we still perceive there's a transmission going on with more or less clarity. But we still perceive it. It's not like we don't have a radio receiver. You know, we have that. It hasn't been entirely disposed of when it comes to fallen man. The problem is we don't always get the right point or emphasis. It's very easy for us to lose track of what it is we're supposed to discover in this relation.
Romans
But there's enough there that the heathen know that there is something objective. And, you know, if you know that there's a signal out there, that there's a transmission out there, it should motivate you to try to get a clearer reception. Especially when you know that this has to do, as the heathen do, that this has to do with your rule of obedience with respect both to God and man. The fact is that the vast majority of men don't do that, and the few that do, do it only because of the working of the Spirit of God. So they're left without excuse. All right, let's look at this last question. Question four, was there another special commandment given or command given to Adam? The answer is yes, beginning at Genesis 2:17.
Genesis 2, verse 17. But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat of it, for in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die.
Okay, so besides the moral law given by way of natural law, there was also what we would call a positive law given. Now, positive laws are laws and institutions which depend solely upon the sovereign will and pleasure of God and have no necessary reference to his nature or the nature of the creation. In other words, there's nothing about the nature of God as creator with respect to the creature that would have suggested don't eat of that tree. In fact, you might even argue, based on what we know from some other things that are said in Genesis, we might actually say, look, when you look on that tree, you can see it's good for fruit, for food. So you might actually argue that there is something in that that at least to all appearances seems to be okay about eating of that tree. But God gave a law. And I've talked about this in different contexts. Upon that law, the entire covenant of works is going to hinge. It gives a positive law, which is only in the will of the lawgiver. It's not something that he could have discovered by nature, by looking around at the creation, or by contemplating the relation of himself to the Creator. It would have never occurred to him, couldn't have. By definition, a positive law just couldn't have suggested itself. Positive laws are direct insertions of the authority of the will of the lawgiver and have no answerability in nature. All right, so they're going to, and this is important, God is giving this to the man in this manner for a particular purpose, for trial. Are these laws he might not have enjoined if he had pleased without making any change in his own nature or the nature of the creation. So this is something he could do or not do. Whereas natural law is, those are those commands, that moral law, that comports with the real relation between the creator and the creature, and then subordinate to that, the creature, the rational creature, to other rational creatures. That is something where God would need to change the nature of the creation and its relation to him for those laws to change. But positive laws don't require that kind of shift. We're not talking about something which is going to change that relation. And of this sort of law was the command not to eat the forbidden fruit, Genesis 3:11.
Genesis 3:11. And he said, "Who told thee that thou wast naked? Hath thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee, and thou shouldest eat?"
Yeah, so how does he come to realize that he has, in fact, departed from the living God? Well, he's made to reflect upon this situation. But this situation is a situation, an event, that's important not because it's grounded in nature, but because it's grounded solely in the will of the lawgiver. Now, why is God doing this? Let me suggest why I think the covenant of works hangs upon a positive command. We would call it a moral command, because it is, in fact, expressive of the will of the lawgiver. And it takes on a dimension, a moral dimension, because of the relation of the creator and creature. If man had fallen with respect to the moral law, the natural moral law, rather than the positive moral law, that moral law which is expressive of that relationship between creator and creature, if he had fallen in that way, it would have forever raised a question about the nature of the creation itself. Did God really create all things good? Or was there some problem in the creation itself? The fact is, because man falls with respect to a positive moral law rather than a natural moral law, that question is forever taken off the shelf. Yes, it's a mystery of iniquity. How is it that this evil arose whereby man put off an obedience to the positive moral command of God? We don't understand the mystery of iniquity. But we cannot trace the breach of that command to any defect in the natural order of things, in the creation itself. That kind of breach is only traceable to the person expressing him or herself by way of that choice contrary to the positive moral command of God. It can't be traced back to a defect in the creation. Now, in addition to that, the laws that are counted positive are the laws concerning the external worship of God, which we call ceremonial laws. These are also positive laws. And these were designed to typify Christ as then to come and to lead to a knowledge of the way of salvation through him. Look at Hebrews 10:1.
Hebrews 10:1. For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never with those sacrifices which they offered year by year continually make the corners thereunto perfect.
And of these, it was predicted that they should come to an end after the death of Christ. We look at Genesis 49:10, Daniel 9:27, compared with Jeremiah 3:16 and Galatians 5:1.
Genesis 49:10. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be.
Daniel 9:27. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and in the midst of the week he shall cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease, and for the overspreading of abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation, and that determined it shall be poured upon the desolate.
Jeremiah 3, verse 16. And it shall come to pass, when ye be multiplied and increased in the land in those days, saith the Lord, they shall say no more the ark of the covenant of the Lord, neither shall it come to mind, neither shall they remember it, neither shall they visit it, neither shall that be done anymore.
Galatians 5:1. Stand fast, therefore, in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, and be not entangled again with the yoke of bondage.
So these are the ceremonial laws are positive moral laws. They're not natural moral law. And that means that they are changeable. That they're not grounded in anything that is inherent in the creation, that is in the nature of God or man or the relation between God and man. There's nothing inherent in them. These are usages which exist solely by reason of the will of the lawgiver. And furthermore, as types and shadows, they have been assigned a typical function by the same sovereign will of God. So we can't just make up what we think these things typify, what these things signify. The Bible is unfolding that to us. It's made plain by God. He has appointed them as types and shadows, and he's appointed the meaning of the types and shadows. And that is all changeable. We know, in fact, that the Bible says that when Christ comes after his death, that these types and shadows will come to an end. And also, the judicial laws given by God for the government of the Jews was partly founded in the law of nature, and partly respecting them as a nation distinct from others in covenant with God. Leviticus 25:13, Deuteronomy 4:41-44, 16:16, and 33:10.
Leviticus 25, verse 13, in the year of this jubilee you shall return every man unto his possession.
Deuteronomy 4, verses 41-44, then Moses severed three cities on this side Jordan toward the sun rising, that the slayer might flee thither which should kill his neighbor unawares and hated him not in times past, and that fleeing unto one of these cities he might live, namely Bezer in the wilderness and the plain country of the Reubenites, and Ramoth and Gilead of the Gadites, and Golan and Bashan of the Manassites. And this is the law which Moses set before the children of Israel.
Deuteronomy 16, verse 16. 3 times in a year shall all thy males appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, in the feast of unleavened bread, and in the feast of weeks, and in the feast of tabernacles, and they shall not appear before the Lord empty.
Deuteronomy 33, verse 10. They shall teach Jacob thy judgments and Israel thy law. They shall put incense before thee and whole burnt sacrifice upon thine altar.
Okay, so as these laws, these judicial laws, as they reflect natural moral law, these things are going to be constant. But they're gonna. That's why we talk about general equity. There's a general equity there. As these laws were framed to be enactments that of moral principles within a context, a formal context of a nation which typifies the church, those laws have a formal ceremonial character. And That's what judicial laws really are. They're laws which are substantially composed of natural moral principles in a context that is ceremonial, which is why we study the general equity principle. Right? Because the external shell of all of this is a matter of positive law. Right? That Israel was a nation. That's natural morality. That Israel's a nation typifying the church, that's something that exists by reason of the positive law. And so we're going to strip away the positive to find what is natural, the general equity principle in these laws. So as far as this law respects the peculiar constitution of the Hebrew nation, it is entirely abrogated. Why? Because it's moral. It's positive moral law. Right? There's a positive aspect to it. But as far as it contains any statute founded in the law of nature, common to all nations, it's still obligatory. Look at 1 Peter 2:13 and 14, 1 Corinthians 9:8 to 10.
1 Peter 2:13 through 14. Submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as the supreme, or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, and for the praise of them that do well.
1 Corinthians 9, verses 8 through 10. Say I these things as a man, or saith not the law the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, Thou shalt not muzzle the mouth of the ox that treadeth out the corn. Doth God take care for oxen? Or saith he it altogether for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he that ploweth should plow in hope, and that he that thresheth in hope should be partaker of his hope.
Okay, so these are laws, then, which are of a mixed sort, judicials. They're partly natural moral law, they're partly positive moral law. To the extent that they are positive, formally, they are positive because they were given to the nation of Israel as a typical state. Not merely as a nation, but as a nation meant to typify the church. That's why we don't keep the judicial laws without some modification, a stripping away of that which is positive. Because with the death of Christ, these positive enactments of the Old Testament have come to an end. These positive laws change with the changing of the guard, if you will, with the changing of of the nature of the revelation before versus after Christ. Right, so these laws are positive and mixed and differ from the moral law, which is universal and unchangeable. Matthew 5, verse 18.
For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one jot or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled.
Right. Again, that's moral law. Now, why is this so important, this distinction? Why am I bringing this up now? What we're talking about in this catechism question is the natural moral law. That positive law that was given to Adam was temporary. Right? The rule, then, the rule of obedience that unto which we're being conducted is the natural moral law, together with, as we'll see, any positive moral refinements peculiar to the New Testament. That is, the revelation of the covenant of grace subsequent to the coming of Christ.
How do we determine what belongs to the moral law, ceremonial law, judicial law when we're reading through the Bible?
The ceremonial laws are going to be all those typical enactments, all these these things surrounding the temple, the sacrifices, the fact that, again, Israel, the church is Israel now. So Israel is receiving these judicial laws both as a nation and as a type of the church. So we've got to look then for the moral kernel and not be stuck with this typical shell. We have to realize that there's been this shift. You know, and Hebrews talks a lot about this shift between the two. So as we read the Bible, we have to continually ask ourselves, are these things which are natural, a matter of natural morality, or are these things something discoverable only by an additional command? And so, you know, when we look at the worship in the Old Testament, it was regulated by the regulative principle. I mean, these are things discoverable only by special revelation, not as a matter of natural morality. And that means that they're all being stripped away. Right? All of those principles are being stripped away. And that's why in the New Testament we also have to follow the regulative principle. You know, that has to do with defining that positive morality that has been superadded to the natural morality. That's exactly where it exists in the realm of positive morality, not natural morality. So really, natural morality, and that's important to why, you know, we're going to be looking at the Ten Commandments. Why are the Ten Commandments even applicable to us as Christians? Well, they actually represent the common morality that exists between the Old and New Testaments. It's actually these principles which have a continuity, and they have a continuity precisely because they're grounded in nature, in the nature of the creation, the nature of God, the nature of man, so on.
Is the same thing can be said about the Book of Psalms, how it is the hymn book of the church, and it's a moral command to sing them?
Psalm singing is a moral command.
Okay, but it's not positive.
A ceremonial command.
Is it a positive moral command?
It's not positive in the sense that certain other things might be positive, because praising God is a matter of natural morality. Right? The Psalms themselves are subject to that positive dimension, but the idea of praising God in Psalms is not.
Okay. So light of nature tells you to praise God, but only divine revelation tells you the moral way
right.
to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Next time we'll continue with this rule, examining this rule that's been given to all mankind.